This is Godweed Evan.
We are a podcast where three friends force another friend, Evan.
Hi.
To listen to a band he doesn't want to listen to.
Ween.
It's a journey. It's wonderful. It's funny. And it's filled with great music.
Except for the Ween.
And the journey.
And the friends.
So listen to it. Or don't. That's what I wanted to do.
Only on the Osiris Podcast Network.
.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. For today's episode, we are doing a re-air of an episode that we recorded a while back, originally aired as number 61, Chuck Guinea on the history of coal. It was part of an energy series that we did. We talked about green energy in one episode, about nuclear energy. It was really a good series. I learned a ton from it. And so we wanted to share this one. All of the other episodes and all episodes 1 through 75 are, as always, available to our patrons. So if you want to hear the other two, you're more than welcome to go there. We'd love to have you. If you're wondering why energy might be on my mind, well, friends, as some of you know, I live in Nashville, Tennessee, where this last week a tornado came through here. Missed us by about two blocks. A lot of my neighbors lost their homes. It's been really hard. We've been out trying to help. And the people who have been here to help has been amazing. All that's to say is that it's a minor inconvenience compared to what a lot of my neighbors went through. But right now, I have no electricity at my house. I haven't had it for about a week. Not for lack of work by the people in the Nashville Electric Service. It has been amazing to see how quickly they've repaired things. But, you know, when you lose electricity for a week, you start thinking about it a lot more than maybe you normally do. And so I was actually working on an episode this week. I thought we'd get power back, but not having power or internet at the house and having to spend a whole day on Tuesday actually helping our neighbors get cleaned up, helping folks get out of their driveways, set me back a little bit, made it hard to arrange an interview. So I thought, what better to do than air this fantastic episode that hasn't been out for a while? And we hope you enjoy it. Aside from that, great news. Bob last week went with his family to St. Jude to have Hallie's scans done. She's clear, and that is fantastic news. I will go every day of my life without power if news like that comes in. It's amazing, and I think a lot of you guys follow Bob and follow Melanie on social media, so you know that good news was there. So just wanted to share it. The episode that will be coming next week, it's been fascinating. Again, you know, when you are living through natural disasters, you start thinking about things and the history of them. And I started working this week on an episode on natural disasters and how they have changed cities over time. And I thought I could get it done by to air this week. But then I realized there's so much there. It's so rich that I'm going to spend this week working on it. Spring break at MTSU, which means I will be spending a lot of time both helping my neighbors recover from a disaster and the other time spending time reading about natural disasters. And that will all be coming at you next week. Also coming at you, The Road to Now Live. We've got our shows coming up. And the next one is here in Nashville, April 18th, as a part of the Nashville Comedy Festival. We're doing 4 p.m. Got guests Langhorne Slim and Tom Shadyac, the director of Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, Bruce Almighty. I mean, every movie, every hit movie, The Nutty Professor, every hit comedy movie of the 90s through the early 2000s. And just a fantastic story. Deep thinker and a good person. So we're really excited about that. Great music, great conversation. We've also got several shows coming up in June. We're going to be in Philadelphia. We're going to be in Berkeley, California. We're going to be the Minneapolis Comedy Festival. So check out our website, theroadtonow.com. Go to the live events tab at the top of the page. And all our shows are listed there. We would love it if you could come out and enjoy a show with us. These live shows have been a lot of fun. So thank you guys for listening. to The Road to Now, and we hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Chuck Kenny on the history of coal. Take care.
Chuck Kenny, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Kenny, you are a native of West Virginia. You're featured in the new National Geographic documentary From the Ashes, which is about coal in America.
Right.
Can you tell us when coal was first discovered in your state, and how did it come to dominate the economy?
Oh, well, it was first discovered as early as the 1700s in what is now West Virginia, but it didn't become a significant engine behind the economy until the 1890s and first decade of the 20th century. So it was around for about 100 years before it became the big economic engine that we know of today. So one of the big misconceptions, even among West Virginians today, is that coal has always been a part of the regional identity, and that's really not the case. There was a long history before coal, so the region itself wasn't always attached. Unfortunately, a lot of people kind of believe that about the region.
So what was the regional identity before coal?
Well, it was more of a, for lack of a better term, mountaineer kind of identity. One of the things I like to point out in my college courses, particularly when I'm teaching West Virginia history, is that actually if you go back before the Civil War, you find that Western Virginia, which is what it was before the Civil War, Western Virginia, actually had a much more diverse economy, a much more forward-looking economy than Eastern Virginia, which was this plantation-based slave economy. And in Western Virginia, you had actually a much more forward-looking economic system with iron, clay, brick-making, glass, various types of livestock industries. So you had a much more diverse economy, a much more forward-looking economy before that. And it wasn't this economy that was based upon industrial extraction.
I think it's always mind-blowing to people in my class when I tell them West Virginia becomes its own state because of that economic diversion, because of the lack of interest in slavery during the Civil War. It becomes a state in 1863.
That's correct.
So then where was coal big, for lack of a better word, before West Virginia? And how did they make the discovery that West Virginia was so rich in coal?
First of all, I mean, if you want to go back to the whole history of coal, England is really the first primary mover of coal. That's the first country that really pushes coal as an energy source. And coal as an energy source goes back in England all the way to the Middle Ages, although it was used primarily then for heating homes. There was one English king, I believe Richard III. It was either Richard III or Edward III. I'm pretty sure it was Richard that banned coal, the burning of coal in London during his reign because it was too sooty. But in Pennsylvania, anthracite coal outside of Philadelphia, I believe, were some of the first coal mines. And also in western Pennsylvania, before it goes down to West Virginia, some coal mining that came out of western Pennsylvania helped power some of the locomotives during the Civil War for the Union Army and helped bring supplies back and forth. So it's with the Industrial Revolution that it really kicks off in a big way. And I guess to answer your question about West Virginia is it's the 1880s where U.S. geologic surveys begin going through the region and begin finding these massive coal reserves. In fact, one of the very famous incidents of Appalachian history is the Hatfield and McCoy feud. And what a lot of people don't realize about that feud is that Devilance Hatfield owned 5,000 acres of land. People wanted that land because they found enormous coal reserves underneath the land that he owned, and that was one of the big drivers of violence in that feud, was to get the Hatfields off the land so that they could get to the coal underneath.
Wow. And how did they manage to do that?
Drive the Hatfields off the land?
Right, yeah, because it sounds like usually when we think about that, it's like a feud between two families, but you're saying this is a much more complex story that involves other interests.
Yeah, it is. Perry Klein, who was related to the McCoys, was one of the big drivers behind the feud and behind the animosity. If you actually look at many of the, shall we say, family conflict, you actually only have some incidents that happened several years apart that really aren't even all that much connected. But when Perry Klein, who lost a lawsuit to Devilance Hatfield, after that, he lost this lawsuit to this disputed land, then they found that there was enormous coal reserves. And he began trying to trump up some incidents that took place between the families, get the national media involved, and try to discredit Hatfields and then hire out bounty hunters to go after the Hatfields. And eventually there was enough violence that the Devil Ant Hatfield sold his land and moved to neighboring Logan County. And the town of Matemois now sits where Devil Lance owned his land. So it became a small railroad town for shipping coal.
Yeah, you bring up Matemois, which brings us to a very interesting series of events in the 20th century there. The way that we imagine the alliance between coal companies and coal workers now, you know, they're just trying to help people keep their jobs. This is not at all the origins of the relationship between mine workers and the companies that own the mines.
That's correct. You go back to the original union leaders, like my great-grandfather, for example, Frank Keeney, who was president of the miners' union, UUMWA, in West Virginia, one of the big leaders in the Pink Creek, Cabin Creek strike. Those guys, they wouldn't be caught dead with a Friends of Coal bumper sticker. That would have just been inconceivable to them. To them, the company's interest and the miners' interest were not one and the same. But that began to change in the 90s.
And what drove those attitudes to change?
Okay, well, you know, I've talked a lot about this recently because I've gotten a lot of calls about, you know, Trump and the appeal of Trump. And I've done a lot of talks and about this within the media over the last few months because of this kind of phenomenon. But really, it goes back to the 90s, really. First of all, you have in the mid-80s and early 90s, the UMWA was finally broken in West Virginia, and largely on a national scale, through 1984-1985 strike, and also later in the Pittston strike and a couple of early strikes in 1991-1992. This was largely because of Don Blankenship. He went on this enormous campaign to try to destroy the union, and he was very open about it. He was very open about trying to break the union. They would go in, they would buy up a union mine, they would close it down, and then they would reopen it 6 months later as a non-union mine, and then only hire non-union workers. Well, this led to huge strikes. Ultimately, the state government and the state police came down on the side of the coal companies, which is kind of a common theme in West Virginia history. The union was broken. When the union was broken in the late 80s, early 90s, you have to understand that they were kind of the counterbalance to the voice of the industry in the media, in the culture. They were always there as a counterweight. When the UMWA lost that influence, there was no real counter voice to that. Now, eventually, you do get a burgeoning environmental movement in Appalachia, but the environmental movement has never had the clout that the UMWA had in its heyday. Because of that, the coal industry has been able to really aggressively step up their propaganda efforts. This was in the 90s. For example, you can look this up on YouTube. I recommend that you do. They had this video, I saw it in high school, called The Greening of Planet Earth. And this went around to all the high schools in central Appalachia. And it was about global warming, and it was saying global warming is happening, but it's going to be a good thing. It's going to help agriculture. It's going to be great. This was brought into the two science classes where I went to high school and all throughout central Appalachia. That's just one example, but they went on a major propaganda campaign to go against environmentalism, to go against unionism. And that's when the Friends of Coal campaign began, Coal in the Classroom campaign, many of these other campaigns which started in the 90s, which helped bring working class people from blue to red, politically speaking. So it was the 2000 election that did that. That was the election with Al Gore and Bush. And that election where West Virginia switched, that changed the election because Gore lost by less than 5 points. And West Virginia's 5 electoral points made the difference in that presidential election. So the blue-collar shift is actually kind of old news. It just seems that now the media is paying attention to it.
And that shift that began maybe in West Virginia and Kentucky has now, as we saw with the 2016 election, moved up into Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. In March of 2016, Hillary Clinton campaigned in Columbus, Ohio, and she said, "We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business." That was perhaps a factor in her losing the election to Donald Trump. but as the From the Ashes documentary, which you are featured in, points out, that it's not regulation or politicians who are putting coal miners out of work. It's new technologies and natural gas. And it's really natural gas that's killing coal. Is that true?
Yes. It's a changing economy. I mean, the economy is quite simply changing. And places that are relying on older types of economies, like this coal model that we have here in Appalachia, are getting left behind. It's not as though we didn't see this coming. So many different factors play into that. We look at Hillary Clinton's comment that was played all over the media here. And people are just now coming around to the fact that we have to change. And as I was trying to say earlier in the interview from the Ashes, I was pointing out that economic diversification away from coal is a conversation we should have had 30 years ago, not a conversation that we should just be beginning to have. I mean, as early as the mid-80s, the population of coal miners had, you know, diminished from 100,000 in the middle part of the century to 30,000 by the mid-80s in West Virginia. So we'd already lost 70,000 jobs regionally, and that's just in coal mining. That's not all the jobs that come from small businesses and things that, you know, are related to the industry. So, I mean, it's been happening for a long time. We knew that this day was coming, but because the industry wants to keep up their profits for as long as possible, because they control the politicians and the media in the region, they've been able to perpetuate this myth that, you know, somehow you can bring back the coal glory days. Not that there ever was any glory days.
Well, yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about, because it's also pointed out in the documentary that mine mechanization began in 1948, and since from 1948 until present day, as the technology of mining improved and advanced, the production increased, and with that corresponding to the increase in production was a dramatic decline in employment, in coal mining employment. Currently, approximately 54,000 coal miner jobs in the United States. That doesn't sound like a whole lot to me.
Right. You know, in West Virginia, the number one employer is Walmart, and they have been for several years now. So this idea that we have to keep coal miners working in order to keep our economy moving is completely blown out of proportion. It's really sad, because you could create more jobs in West Virginia with solar power on mountaintop removal sites than you could by reviving the coal industry, and nobody would die from black lung. It seems like a no-brainer to me.
Then how do you think that coal has captured America's imagination? As you point out, you're talking about 30,000 jobs. How is it that this has, because obviously it's the key point, you know, when Donald Trump announced his decision to bail out of the Paris Climate Accords, he talked about coal miners a lot. Why do we as Americans care so much about this industry?
It's a very good question, and I'm not sure that I have a complete answer for you. I guess that I can say there's some kind of glorification of the perhaps blue-collar heyday of American manufacturing and industrial production. You know, in the late 1890s, early 1900s, we overtook all other countries in the world as far as our economy and our industrial blue-collar, you know, that kind of tradition really sprang up quickly, but it became a very dominant part of American life. And I think some of this, not just with coal miners, but also, you know, say manufacturing jobs in what is now called the Rust Belt, this notion that, you know, we had this enormously successful manufacturing, blue-collar, industrial past, and somehow we can get back to it. It's a very interesting fascination that we have with it, almost a romanticization of it. It's quite interesting. It's quite fascinating, really.
It makes sense when you say it like that, because then it's bound up in this imagined past evoked by the campaign slogan, Make America Great Again.
Right. Turn back the clock.
Well, can we talk for a minute about coal as a source of energy?
I'm doing more research about this, but Thomas Edison invented the first coal-fired power plant, by the way, and it was in Manhattan, I believe, the very first coal-fired power plant, 1882, is when it was opened up. And Edison kind of developed the coal-fired power plant as a means of promoting his other new invention, the light bulb. And what we're finding out, or at least what I've been finding out by doing some reading, and I have much more research on this to do, is it appears as though we didn't have to even go with coal to begin with. That there were, they were already originally cities were looking into alternative forms of electrical generation. But General Electric and several other big captains of industry saw how they could consolidate with big power plants. You could power entire cities with singular power plants, and that would enable to give them a monopoly over the electric industry. And they aggressively pushed out other types of electrical generation in order to gain that monopoly. So from the very beginning, there were alternatives to coal. There's this notion that coal built, you know, coal was responsible for the Industrial Revolution, and there's no doubt it played a crucial, pivotal role. There's no doubt about that. At the same time, it's been thought that coal was the only option we had until recently, but that's really not necessarily the truth. Coal is, of course, always going to be important as in steel production, metallurgic coal. As long as we're making steel, we're going to continue to need some forms of coal mining, but only about, say, 10 to 15% of the coal mining currently out of West Virginia is metallurgic coal. That number has gone up and down over the course of years, but there's always going to be some market for that. And I think the only thing that can ever revive coal in a significant amount is a Third World War, which unfortunately may be more of a possibility than what we might like to admit right now.
So speaking about you spoke earlier about the story, you know, what we don't hear and what we do hear. Could you tell us about the mine wars that took place in West Virginia in the early 20th century?
Oh, yes. I can talk mine wars all day.
And also the origins of the Union.
Yeah, yes, several things. The United Mine Workers first began in 1890 in Springfield, Illinois. But they didn't spread to West Virginia really until the 1912-1913 Pink Creek Cabin Creek strike is when they really broke into West Virginia. And what happened, coal companies, railroad companies, and other types of industrial companies from U.S. Steel, Standard Oil, even Rockefeller's company, came in, and there was a big land grab in central Appalachia during this time period. Over 70% of the land in West Virginia currently is absentee owned, by the way, and it was even higher during the industrial age. So you have outside corporations that came in and bought up huge portions of the land, and in most cases kicking off Native mountaineers. My family was among them. For example, my family moved into the region in 1751, and then they lost their land to coal company. The people eventually rose up against this company town system, and they had this basically industrial police state known as the mine guard system, in which they had basically the private armies. For example, in Logan County, West Virginia, Sheriff Don Chafin had 300 deputies. Now, this is a county that I think there are four. In Logan County, West Virginia. Well, he had 300 a century ago. And it was meant to keep the Union out. They opened people's mail. They voted for you, by the way. In company towns on election day, you went to the booth and your mine superintendent filled out your ballot for you. So you didn't have any freedom to vote. You were paid in company money, not American money. And in some cases, company money was so specified. We have one of these in our Mine Wars Museum that I co-founded, Inmate One. It's a piece of script for one loaf of bread, meaning that the miner was paid, and the only thing they could get with the coin was a loaf of bread. So not only are they not getting paid in real money, but what they can buy is being dictated to them. So this is an un-American system, and miners unionized and rose up against that. And this was more of a spontaneous uprising by the miners themselves, and then the UMWA kind of piggybacked onto that, so to speak, because union leaders weren't necessarily too enthusiastic about some of the local leaders, like my great-grandfather, who were very open to using violence and direct action against the mine guards. So this led to a series of huge violent conflicts that went from 1912 all the way into the 20s, culminated with the Battle of Bear Mountain in 1921, in which roughly around 10,000 coal miners formed an army. They controlled up to 500 square miles of territory. They marched from Charleston all the way down into the southern counties with the intent of forcefully ending the mine guard system. The coal companies put an army at Blair Mountain and on top of these ridge lines, basically to stop advancing miners' army. actually, the setup was in very similar to the military setup of the Battle of Gettysburg. The kind of the coal companies on the ridge lines up on top and the miners down below. And it was fighting for 4 days. It was fighting along the 10-mile front. And eventually the federal government came in. The miners surrendered to federal troops because many of them were World War I veterans and they didn't want to attack American soldiers. They had no problem killing coal company soldiers, but they didn't want to kill American military soldiers. They surrendered. There were treason trials which followed that. It stands as the largest challenge to industrial domination which took place in West Virginia, and that's why there's still such a controversy over the very site where the battle took place, because the coal companies want to destroy the site with mountaintop removal. Preservationists like me want to save it. And one of the reasons they want to destroy it is not for the coal, because there's really not a lot of coal there. They want to wipe out the history. They don't want to see a monument to a challenge to their authority. And I know this because I've sat across from the table. I've tried to negotiate deals with West Virginia Coal Association, Natural Resource Partners, Arch Coal, and Alpha Natural Resources. I've actually tried to negotiate a deal to preserve the battlefield with them, and they don't want to see this history preserved, period.
Well, tell us a little bit about the congressional representatives from West Virginia that are in Washington. I think Joe Manchin's probably the more of a household name. But where do you know, what is it all Republican Party rule there, or are there still some old school Democrats? Is it changing at all?
As I said before, it's becoming more red since 2000. Joe Manchin, of course, is probably the most prominent, even though he's a Democrat. But he is at best a kind of a FDR Democrat. You know, at its very best. I mean, you'll never hear him use the word climate change. You just won't, even though he's a Democrat. It doesn't, as far as the Democrats, it doesn't look good for the Democratic Party in West Virginia in the future, even though our governor is currently Democrat. He's also a coal operator who was a Republican and just switched over to the Democratic Party right before the election. With Manchin, even though he is a Democrat, and he's a moderate, in some sense a moderate, he is never going to advance, say, environmental policies that the National Democratic Party advances. And the way it is, the way the political climate is today in West Virginia, to mention climate change as a candidate is to commit political suicide within the state.
Which is amazing, because you just said earlier that in the 90s they put out propaganda that said that there was climate change and that it was cool.
Right. It was a good thing. It was going to help.
It is such a beautiful state. I mean, with amazing people. We've been there. Our band has been through there many times over the past 16 years, and we've always been embraced by the crowds there and the people there. Are there any industries, any new businesses that have been able to get a foothold to help change the economy of West Virginia and to offer more opportunity for a more diverse population?
Yeah. First of all, it is a cool place that does have a lot of cool people. And yes, it is very beautiful. You know, the places that haven't been touched. The natural gas industry is beginning to fill up the spaces where the coal industry is leaving. And I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. I haven't studied fracking perhaps as well as I should have, but basically the small amount I've read about it says that it could potentially damage water severely, cause earthquakes. There's a lot of serious environmental issues with that. Plus, natural gas fracking jobs aren't long-term, but the natural gas industry is coming up in a big way, because of the Marcellus Shale, which goes into portions of West Virginia. And there's another very, very huge natural gas deposit that's bigger than Marcellus, that's in the southern portion of the state. So in some sense, we're kind of switching out one extraction industry for another. You've seen a lot of crazy bills that have been put forth in the state legislature in the last 2 years, one of which enabled gas companies to survey your property without your permission. Because of this notion of that we're desperate for jobs, they're willing to let the gas industry come in and do whatever they want, just in order to create a few jobs. And it's difficult to get other types of businesses to come in because, you know, even though the state's very pretty, you know, do you want to come into a coal community where you're not sure if the water is healthy to drink, you're not sure about the air quality? There's a lot of things to deter outside businesses. There's a lot of work to do before we can really open the state up to a lot of new things. And people have to be really, really willing to let that happen. And unfortunately, I still think people are still clinging in that last bit, this imagined economic glory that coal once supposedly had.
There's a deep irony there in the fact that the standard line coming out of the coal industry is that it is government that is killing coal. When you know, you actually look back at it, and in the past and in the present, coal has used the government very effectively to push its agenda when that worked out for coal.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a really good point. They don't want government. When they say they don't want government interference, what they mean is they don't want any kind of government interference that hurts them. They're perfectly willing to have government interference when it's to their advantage. They weren't worried about government interference, for example, at Blair Mountain when the federal government came in. They're not worried about government interference when they're breaking a strike. That's when government interference is great. But yes, you're exactly right. They've used government to their advantage in every way. And it kind of upsets me whenever you turn on Fox News and they talk about the carbon tax or subsidies for solar energy. And they say, well, you can't pick winners and losers. Well, that's what they did from the very beginning, is picking the coal industry as a winner in that. You know, that's what established those industries, is by picking winners and losers early on.
Is it possible that the coal industry will kind of die out on its own? I mean, just by attrition?
I just think that eventually, for example, you didn't need to convince people to abandon horses once the automobile became available. Once things like for example, solar energy, when that becomes more affordable, when the technology improves enough, when consumers have a choice, if you have a choice, if you can have cheap solar energy and you know that you have the potential to go off the grid, you don't need power lines, those types of technology is better. Consumers are going to gravitate towards that when they become available. So I think it's only a matter of time. But the problem, of course, is that in places, you know, like West Virginia, where the industry has such a dominance, they'll cling to it for so long that, you know, when they leave, there has been no preparation for what comes next. And that's what the unfortunate thing that we're seeing now.
Chuck, how did you get interested in this topic? What led you to dedicate your life to studying coal and its history and the Appalachian and particularly West Virginia region?
Well, yeah, I actually did not intend to study coal. That was not my intent. When I was a kid, I began hearing stories about my great-grandfather, Frank Keeney. In fact, the very first time I ever heard about him was at a family reunion. I was about maybe 7 years old, 8 years old, and I was out back playing with a toy knife, one of these little toy plastic knives, trying to throw it into the side of the hill, you know, like they do in movies. And an older relative came up to me and said, oh, you need to learn how to throw that thing correctly. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, you know, you never know when a Baldwin Phelps mine guard might be after you. And I, of course, had no idea when I was a kid. I'm like, what are you talking about? What's a mine guard? The guy leaned down and said, don't you know who your family is? And, of course, I had no idea. And he begins to tell me about, you know, a little bit about the mine wars. I run to my dad, and my family really hadn't talked to me about that. And I began to hear stories about Blair Mountain, about all of the different things that happened from my family members, not from the classroom. And then that began to, you know, when I went to the eighth grade to take my West Virginia history course that everybody has to take here, I went to my teacher and said, when are we going to cover the mine wars? What can you tell me about Frank Keeney? Well, she had no idea about the mine wars or Frank Keeney. And so that got me curious. Why did all this stuff happen? This really interesting, fascinating history with all this drama and excitement, and nobody's talking about it. That was the fundamental question that led me into it deeper and deeper. Through a series of circumstances, I ended up taking a job as I was finishing my doctoral work at West Virginia University, largely because it was just open, and I wasn't finished with my dissertation yet, and so I thought I would take it. So I go down there, and suddenly I'm in the midst of all this, right when the Blair Mountain controversy really started heating up, right when all this election stuff, you know, this huge political shift is happening. And it just kind of involuntarily immersed me into everything. And so it's kind of the culmination of a number of things. But it's a very personal history to me, specifically with the mine wars and the struggle of resistance against the industry and my family's role in that, that kind of has, you know, driven me to where I am.
That's an amazing story, Chuck. And that's what The Road to Now is all about. It's how does that personal narrative fit in with the larger historical narrative? And you are a living example of that. And we're just so glad that you've decided to dedicate your life to telling that story, your family story, your state story. It's just, you're a really, from everything I've read and seen, you've done a lot of documentaries, and you are a great historian and a great asset to us all. Thanks so much for joining us today, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.
Well, yes, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking with you guys.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thanks for listening, and take care.